Please be seated. Sorry about the delay. We've just got some equipment issues, but we are recording, but we're not necessarily sending information that we need to be sending simultaneously with the record through to the transcription service, so that may impact on the production of a transcript. So just working through those issues now, and we'll see if there isn't spare equipment somewhere in the country that can be sent down. But we are recording, so that's the main thing. Alrighty, where are we? Ms. Williams.
Yes, thank you, Your Honour. Yeah. So before lunch, Mr. De Pelsenmaker, I was exploring with you the issue around application of deemed priorities, and Her Honour suggested perhaps that I find some evidence to that point to put before you. Yeah. So I have thought about that and looked into that somewhat over the adjournment, and where I've got to, Your Honour, is that I don't think there's any particular evidence currently before the court which I can point to. Mm-hmm. What I would put to the court is that when you have the lay persons, lay parties appearing before you in Cromwell, that I expect that that will be an issue for some of them, and that might be an issue that the court could explore with those persons.
Yeah, I mean, those folk who are wanting to maintain those priorities?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. But you won't be there?
I won't be there, Your Honour, I'm sorry.
No.
I am expecting to either be in Invercargill or in the High Court.
The only other witness that you can put this line of questioning to would be Miss Dicey.
Yes, and I am down to cross-examine Miss Dicey, yeah. Your Honour.
Okay. And I did check her evidence and I couldn't see any reasoning, so you'll need to explore with Miss Dicey why she makes that recommendation.
Yes.
Yeah. All right, yes. Thank you.
Yes. So really, the only just concluding matter I just want to put to you, Mr. De Pelsenmaker, is that, again, in terms of the controlled activity, if there is no provision for continuation of priorities, perhaps as a take cessation condition, as one of those matters of control, then again, it's simply not something that can be addressed, is it?
Correct. Yep.
Okay. Thank you. Moving on to the application of... Sorry, I'll keep myself by the microphone. The application of Schedule 2A... and the minimum flows which are in the schedule but currently not operative?
They are operative, but they are not imposed as a condition on consents.
Okay. And in the conversation or discussion that you had with Commissioner Edmonds yesterday, what you told the court was that, in part, that was because the large number of deemed permits in some of those catchments meant that the minimum flows were not going to be effective because you would have a large number of consents, effectively, which would not be subject to those minimum flows.
Correct.
What we now have, however, is a situation where the deemed permits are expiring and where we anticipate that for, I think we've got it down to around 200, but still quite a sizeable number, and particularly in the Manahirakia catchment, a sizeable number who are all applying for replacement consents at the same time.
Correct.
Does that change your view about the utility of the Schedule 2A minimum flows?
In regards to the Manahirakia, we heard previous evidence that I believe we... That the minimum flow actually is irrelevant because it's an augmented river. At the point where the minimum flow is measured, you have flows released from false dam that artificially increase that flow. So the bottleneck of the river is further down the minimum flow side. With regard to other rivers, the Schedule 2A minimum flows, they're going to be reviewed.
Mm-hmm.
We have, in some cases, there is quite some technical work done behind them. In other cases, especially with the older ones, the ones that were set at the time the plan was notified and made operative, there is, in some cases, no or very little scientific basis for it. So the effectiveness of those minimum flows is, in some cases, at best doubtful. The other matter that I thought about as well is, And I thought about it in relation with your earlier proposal about maintaining existing flow regimes. Mm. How do the two work together? Because if you have a minimum flow requirement all of a sudden, the irrigators that previously were in the priority system might have to change how they take water. So it was one of the reasons also why I didn't have a clear steer as to how the two would work together, those two requirements, so to speak.
Again, though, looking at your proposed wording for Rule 10A311, which is that controlled activity rule, paragraph F, sorry, that's on the next page, I think.
Yeah.
So paragraph F is the matter of control dealing with minimum flow, residual flow, or take cessation condition.
You're talking of page 7, is that correct?
Yes, I am.
Yeah.
I think. It's a bit hard to tell. But yes, in your revised corrections as at 4 March 2021 version of the plan change.
Yeah, so it is a matter of of discretion, and I think it's also
that may be replicated in the restricted discretionary rule.
It's in the restricted discretionary rule.
Discussing that, but we'll leave that to one side. Actually, the way it's phrased in the rule here is simply minimum flow, residual flow, or take cessation conditions. It's only when you go up to the policy.
Record is working.
And in policy 10A21D, that's where it talks about existing residual flow, minimum flow, or take cessation condition being applied to a new permit. So I guess there's a distinction, and I'm wondering if there is a useful distinction between the existing minimum flow, et cetera, in the policy, as opposed to the matters of control which are reserved in the rule, which actually don't make that distinction.
No, and it's deliberate. Because the policy is basically sets out a requirement,
yep,
which you need to meet in order to get resource consent.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't meet it, you don't get a resource consent. The wording in the matter of control and also the matter of discretion, which refers to minimum flows, residual flows, or take cessation conditions in general, allows consent officers to go beyond that. But it's not a requirement. It is at their discretion, really.
Yeah, can we just pause there? I just want to think about your answer whilst also looking at the provisions at the same time. So is that kind of like the same issue I raised? What's this matter of discretion? Yeah. Okay, you pursue it. This is interesting.
That is interesting.
How will it be exercised relative to any policy?
Mm.
Yeah.
So there is this issue which Her Honour has alluded to already with you this morning around where is the support for the matters of discretion in the policy and the objectives, and I'm going to put that to one side for the moment. But coming back to the matters of discretion in the rule, which are helpfully up on the screen there, what you've now told us is that this is not confined to existing minimum flows, residual flows, or take cessation conditions.
That is correct, yeah.
There is then the ability for consents officers to, if they are dealing with all applications for a number of takes from a catchment, to impose a minimum flow consistent with the current Schedule 2A flow.
Or if there is no minimum flow in the Schedule another minimum flow condition or a residual flow condition. That's correct, yeah.
There is a bit of a policy gap, though. And is that sufficiently accounted for in that current wording in policy 10A21?
Well, the wording in policy, sorry, 10A21D only applies in circumstances where there is a minimum flow condition or residual flow condition on an existing consent. It requires you to set it over. It does not, provide you with policy direction. To set a minimum flow in all circumstances.
And I'm certainly not asking for that policy direction because I accept that there is a lack of information. We've had evidence about that. My point is where we have flows which are set, admittedly, some time ago and admittedly perhaps on limited information, but there is at least something there. So the question is, you have a figure. It's in the plan. It's been in the plan for some time. It was in the plan with the expectation that it would be implemented by October this year. What is the harm in allowing that to then apply?
In an ecological sense, there would be, in general, I'm not an ecologist either, there would be, I would assume, little harm.
And there could indeed be a benefit, couldn't there? Because it is requiring at least a level of ecological ecosystem protection.
There could be a benefit, yes.
All right. Thank you, Your Honour. I think I will leave it there.
So just to check the mud, I've understood this correctly. Your evidence is that there is a general policy together with a controlled activity, an RDA rule, with an entry condition pertaining to an existing residual flow, minimum flow, cessation condition. If that exists on your, you know, on your water permit, it is to be included in the application.
Correct.
So, okay, we're past that gateway and assuming all other gateways. Then in terms of deciding the resource consent, the council reserves control over the following matters, including, you know, minimum flow, residual flow, or cessation conditions. And how you imagine this working is that all applications, provided they pass the gateways, regardless of whether they, you know, they're passing the gate, regardless of whether or not they have existing conditions of that ilk, matters of discretion include minimum flow, residual flow, cessation conditions.
Correct.
So they may not have. So, for example, I, you know, might be an applicant. I don't have one of those existing conditions, but nevertheless, I'm through the gateway.
You are through the gateway, yeah.
And I could be exposed to a minimum flow, residual flow, or cessation condition.
If there is a need for that or a clear benefit, then yeah.
Okay. So
consent officers have that option.
Okay. So what's the policy imperative, or what's the policy that is implementing in terms of a need for it or a benefit for it?
There is no policy within Plan Change 7 for that.
Okay, so are we looking like another orphan, an orphan provision here? What would guide the consent officer's decision making?
It is a standalone chapter for existing water permits. So you'd be confined to the scope of what is in the proposed Chapter 10A.
But you said they're orphaned, this provision's orphaned.
Yeah. They're orphaned. One of the considerations that consent officers may take into may have regard to is the NPSFM as well, like, for example.
Well, that's actually the point that Mr. Winchester makes, and makes is actually with very good reason, is whether or not that consideration could be brought down when looking at a controlled activity or an RDA. And so that's actually a legal issue, which his lawyer will now have to grapple with. Mr. Winchester makes the point because Mr. Winchester had a case of Naitahu involving Rangitata diversion recently where that very issue came up. Yeah. That be correct, Mr. Winchester? That's what you had in mind?
Yes.
Yeah. Mm. So that's a legal issue. It's a pretty significant one. If council's thinking this will all work out because, you know, we can bring this down and it's a relevant consideration, and it's not. And the absence of parents is going to be important as well, so we just need to think about that. I guess that's for re-examination whether it truly is orphaned. But if it is, then what? Yeah. All right. Thank you. Who's next? Ms. Dixon.
Your Honour. Good afternoon, Mr. De Pilsmaker.
Good afternoon.
I want to take you to a number of paragraphs in your evidence in chief, so if you make sure you have that handy, please, as we start. And my first question is actually really one, I hope, just of clarification. So if we can start with paragraph 108, please, of your evidence in chief.
Yes.
Just waiting for the court to get there too. You say in paragraph 108 that the key outcome that PC7 is seeking to achieve is to facilitate, at least in part, the transition towards new long-term sustainable freshwater management, etc. In part or entirely? Surely entirely.
Well, we cannot achieve... there will be consents, existing consents that are not captured by Plan Change 7, consents that are granted before the plan change was notified.
Sure.
And they could be for long term, so it will be hard to transition them towards that new planning regime within the lifespan of the plan.
But we are transitioning towards a new framework.
That's correct.
And that is the purpose of this plan change.
That is the purpose, yeah.
If we can go from there, please, to paragraph 27B, Roman numeral 3. And in that paragraph, you were discussing... first of all, Professor Skelton's report, and then the Minister's recommendation on the back of that report, which is to prepare a plan change that will provide an adequate interim planning and consenting framework to manage freshwater, etc., etc. Adequate means, in my suggestion, do enough, something less than perfect. Would that be a fair
yes.
definition
yeah.
or synonym for adequate? So the recognition here is that this plan change is not going to be all things to all people.
No.
But
and
it's going to transition, as we were saying before.
It's a transitional plan. It is not our intent to fully give effect to higher order planning documents.
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay. Paragraph 44, please, next. At paragraph 44, you say that there are five significant resource management issues that PC7 seeks to address, all of which are strongly interlinked. I just want to explore with you slightly what you mean there by to address, because in fact what you're really saying, I think, is that PC7, to use words you've used elsewhere, is holding the line in order that, in fact, the coming Land and Water Plan can address these issues.
Mm. I agree with you. Really, a better phrasing would perhaps be that PC7 stems from these resource management issues and that those issues actually require us to take action. The plan change, by itself, it cannot address things like, you know, gaps in our data knowledge and things like that. It does address some aspects of it. For example, we're trying to go to some degree in, we're trying to make some headway in terms of dealing with the allocation issue through the plan change. But yeah, I agree with you.
But the plan change is not going to solve those problems, is it?
Not entirely, no.
All right, with that in mind, I want to turn to the two issues that you have expressed some hesitancy over and, in fact, have left open until you've heard, I think you said, until you've heard the evidence and cross-examination, I think, too, of other witnesses.
Correct.
And the two issues that I'm referring to are the question of hydro generation and how it's provided for. And secondly, that of municipal supply, which of course includes drinking water. Now, both those issues are subject to national policy statements in their own right. Is that correct?
That is correct, yeah.
So in the case of hydro generation, we're talking about the NPS, renewable electricity generation.
That is correct, yes.
That's correct. And in the case of drinking water, and it's drinking water I'm particularly concerned about, it itself was covered by the NPS Freshwater Management 2020.
That is correct.
Right. And there is an obligation for a plan to give effect to NPSs under the Resource Management Act.
Correct.
Yeah. All right, so let's just start with the hydro question then, because I think it's important to understand, in light of the fact that this is an interim plan change, and your expressed view that in other places that this is about rolling over, holding the line, etc., the scale of hydro issues that might be subject to this particular interim plan change before the full Land and Water Plan comes into force. I presume you're aware, for example, that the Clutha scheme is consented to 2042?
Yes, I'm aware.
And the Waipori scheme to 2038?
2038. Aspects of it, I believe.
I'm sure Mr. Welsh can address that more with you. But the point that I'm making is that the big takes, you know, the big schemes, are in fact not going to be subject to this plan change, because by the time they come round for reconsenting, the big water takes, we hope very much that the new Land and Water Plan will be firmly embedded in place. Do you agree?
I can confirm that that's definitely the case for the contact consents.
The contact, yeah. Right. So, in reality, we are talking for the lifetime of this interim planning position about some deemed consents which need to be rolled over. And Mr. Welsh said yesterday that given the number that are being surrendered, I think we're down to about something like seven in this context. Is that your understanding of the situation that applies during the lifetime of the interim plan change?
I could not confirm the exact number.
Sure.
It seems a reasonable number, but I do consider that there are a number of hydro schemes operating, not necessarily with a deemed permit, but with a resource consent within deemed permit-dominated catchments as well. So it is almost like a holistic system, in a way, that we need to consider.
accept that, but the focus has been on not locking in big takes. And my point to you is that this is an interim plan change with another real plan coming, and actually there's really little danger of locking in big takes, given what's at stake in the next few years. Is that a fair summation? It's just a question of getting the thing in proportion, really.
Mm. What do you mean with locking in?
Well, the concern is that anybody who consents anything during this period, unless they're confined to a six-year period or whatever, it's about preventing big water take consents getting 35-year consents, as has been the pattern in the past. So, isn't it a reasonable position, particularly given the national policy statements that sit behind hydro, and we haven't talked about drinking water, but also sit behind drinking water, that actually addressing those issues doesn't need to happen in the context of this plan change, but in fact can wait for the land water plan that's coming?
Yes, and I think that's the appropriate way, because there is a cascade of planning documents mm-hmm. that we need to take into account. We have an RPS, but as you know, it's being reviewed as well.
Yes.
I would assume that dealing with matters such as how you deal with community drinking water supplies, hydroelectricity, we will get some direction on that in the RPS. It then makes sense mm-hmm. to incorporate that into the new land and water plan, and I think that's the right place to set up a framework specifically for that.
Thank you. You see, my concern is, and it's not just about those two issues, but a broader concern that as we go further and further in cross-examination and evidence and discussion and so on into the detail of what should be in this particular plan change, more and more is being added. And I particularly noted your comment this morning that in answer to, I think, to the court, that we, and I think you were talking about council, want to consider activities as soon as possible and bring them in line with the new land and water plan. And forgive me if I haven't written that down absolutely accurately, but that was the gist of what you said. And my point to you is, this is interim. There are something like 500 consents. I think we're down to about 200 or so of the deemed consents, but there's still another 200 or so at least. So 400 to 500 consents sitting out there that have to be dealt with in very short order. Isn't the risk, if you start to anticipate activities that really belong in the new and the coming land and water plan, the risk is that this plan change simply will not be able to deal with what it has to deal with in the next few months after it becomes operative?
This plan change is intended to allow those activities to continue as they have done in the past.
Yes.
So if that is a if you consider, is that what you mean with a risk or?
The risk is that the consent simply can't be processed in the time. What I'm thinking about is, in addition to your comment this morning, which to me looks as if you're trying to do more in this plan change than is actually an interim position, but I'm also thinking about a discussion you had this morning, I think, with Her Honour, around what some of the conditions and the controlled activity mm-hmm. rule might lead a consent officer to look at, and it was the discussion around efficiency. The more we put into, I think you'd accept, those rules, and the plan change is kind of growing all the time, the more that goes into those rules, the more planning officers have the opportunity or the invitation or the discretion to start looking behind those controlled activity conditions, the more complicated this process becomes, and the more at risk it is of actually being able to achieve what it is intended to achieve. Isn't that true?
The key objective is still to make sure that we get those activities aligned with a new management regime as quickly as possible. So I guess it's a trade-off. We can add perhaps more complexity, but if that serves the bigger purpose, I guess it might be worthwhile doing that.
We're looking for something that's adequate. We're not looking for perfection. Yeah?
I think Council's proposition is that you add less complexity. Would that be it? Yes.
Exactly, yes. Yeah. And that's my concern about the way in which more and more is being added into this plan change as we go.
It's the question of where are those discretions that you talk about. And to be fair, I hadn't actually appreciated until Ms Williams cross-examined you as to the minimum flow discretion. Where's it going to take you? Is it going to get your consents team bogged down processing consents when they ought to have their mind on something else? And I think that's the problem, and that's the problem that I think that the minister's trying to... It lies behind the minister's own amendments or preferred relief, yeah.
Yes, you're right. I'm thinking about where the minister began in this exercise, and as it's expressed actually through the evidence, but it seems to me that, and I'm putting really to Mr. De Pelsmaker, that there's a risk that just we lose sight of that, and the whole plan change is actually undermined by its own weight at the end of the day.
In terms of providing for sufficient capacity to deal with all these consents, that is not a question that I can answer. As an organisation, I think ORC, needs to take that into account and provide for that. In terms of adding complexity, initially, if we take it back to Professor Skelton's recommendation was just to simply roll over, let some of those activities continue. We've added a little bit of complexity to that, not a lot, I would assume. But again, I come back to the issue, like if we start carving out certain activities out of the plan change, then it becomes also more difficult to achieve the outcomes, because the outcomes need to be achieved, and I'm talking about outcomes in an environmental sense, by all those activities working towards the same outcome as well.
But if those outcomes can wait till the Land and Water Plan, shouldn't they wait till the Land and Water Plan?
Yes, but we do not set environmental outcomes in Plan Change 7.
Yes. Right. Just coming back to the NPSs for a moment. One of the outlying, I suppose, type questions is if there is going to be some specific provision made for hydro generation in particular, and also for municipal water, where that should lie in the plan change.
So I recommended that. My view on that was to keep those activities within the scope of Plan Change 7. Specific concerns were raised about really the ability of those operators and those consent holders to abstract sufficient water. I think that is a very mechanical issue that can be best addressed through the schedule, just making sure that the schedule does not act as an impediment for those activities to continue to operate in the manner that they have.
I understand that. My question to you really is, though, isn't it appropriate that matters which are subject to an NPS should be in the body of the plan change itself rather than a schedule?
I don't think so. Again, because this is an interim planning framework, we propose to deal with these through the land and water plan. I while those might be subject to an, while they are subject to an NPS, I think we need to make sure that all the NPSs are achieved at the same level. And I think by providing for those activities now in Plan Change 7, there is a risk that we lock ourselves in.
It's not a question of whether it's appropriate to provide for them. My suggestion, obviously, is that it is. Mm-hmm. It's where in the plan change that it goes. And
yeah.
I'm interested in your comment that you think it's appropriate to put in the schedule.
That was my thought. I considered the evidence that was provided by Ms. Stiles in relation to hydroelectricity generation, Mr. Twos as well, and I think Mr. Ensor on behalf of MFE.
Right.
And I'm happy to discuss these in more detail, but they did not seem to achieve what I believe to be the intent, or what I think is the intent of the plan change.
It may be a matter that can be subject to the planners' conferencing.
Yeah.
The last matter I wanted to discuss with you, Mr. De Pelsmaker, is actually an extension almost of the conversation we've been having. It's around the general framework of the plan change. Would you accept that when this was drafted, that the intent was that there would be a controlled activity rule and a non-complying rule, and the two would act more or less like carrot and stick? Here's the controlled activity process. The carrot is, yes, you'll have to put up with 6 years. If you're an applicant, 6 years is what you're going to get, but it's a nice, simple, straightforward process and you have some certainty around it. If you're not willing to accept 6 years, then you can go down the non-complying pathway, and obviously life is going to get more difficult. That was the
current
stick approach? Right. And I presume you'd accept, too, that the nice, clean lines of that, if you like, have got a bit lost by the fact that lying behind the controlled activity rule is the continued survival of the operative water plan, and that as a result of that, as Mr. Moore discussed in his legal submissions, as a result of that, because applicants find themselves effectively having to apply for restricted discretionary status rather than the nice straightforward controlled activity status, in fact, they're tending to apply for non-complying activity and try and get the longer time period. That's what's happening. In practice, that's the way it's working out. Coming back again to that question that, or the point that I made before about the scale and magnitude, you know, the number of applications that are sitting out there to be processed and getting this thing workable. If it were possible for the planners to caucus not just on the methodology, which is well underway and organised, and obviously the methodology is an aspect of the controlled activity rule, but if a planning caucus were able to get some consensus on the shape of the controlled activity rule itself, would you consider there would be some merit in trying to get that rule operative early? And obviously this is a discussion that we would have to have with Her Honour and the commissioners, but some merit in trying to get the controlled activity rule operative so that, in fact, this problem of the restricted discretionary activity status lying behind could fall away, and that would assist the late deemed applicants, and it would assist the applicants looking to make their applications, the ones that expire in 2025, so they're applying over the next couple of years. Can you see that there would be some merit in trying to reach that sort of position?
As an interim measure, you mean? So we make the controlled activity operative and keep on working on fine-tuning the non-complying pathway? Is that
almost like dealing with this plan change in stages?
Speed has always been of crucial importance for the plan change to be effective.
Mm-hmm.
So I would agree with you.
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honour.
All right, thank you.
You need a lectern? Oh, okay, no, that's fine. Okay, with you.
Thank you. Now, Mr. Pelsmaker, I'm just going to pick up on one point that Her Honour took you to at the start in terms of how the operative regional plan integrates between changes in land use and water takes. And you were asked some questions about when a land use creates either leaching through the soil or overland discharges. And you just touched on briefly that it was started off as an effects-based permitted activity framework. And just to round that off, I just wanted to take you to the rules I think you were thinking of in the plan. So they're in Volume 1 of the Common Bundle. If you go to Common Bundle CB218...
And if you could just give me the rule reference.
And the rule reference is 12C11 big A. So is it correct that that rule there is the permitted activity rule, which states that where you meet the limit in Schedule 16A, you are effectively a permitted direct discharge?
Correct.
And that rule applies from 1 April 20, or applied from 1 April 2020? Is that correct?
Correct, but we have undertaken a plan change recently, plan change 6AA, which defers the dates by which that aspect of the rule compliance with the schedule becomes mandatory.
So is the version in the Common Bundle not been updated to reflect that? Should it say 2026?
I think it should.
So this is a permitted activity rule?
In the schedule, sorry. It is in the schedule.
Well, no. I've just got the version I've downloaded from the website, the council website. Mm-hmm. The version on the council website of 12C11 capital A from 1 April 2026, the schedule 16A limits apply.
Yeah.
So perhaps the Common Bundle could be updated. Mm. So in that case, where you've got a change in land use that comes with it a potential change in overland flow and direct discharge to a surface water body, there are no water quality limits that apply until 2026 now.
That is correct.
And the same situation is for the leaching of nitrogen, isn't it?
That is correct.
Which is Rule 12C13. The nitrogen limits in that rule do not apply until 2026.
What rule is that again? Sorry?
12C13.
13.
So from April 2026, depending on what nitrogen-sensitive zone a discharge is in, there's limits of kilograms of nitrogen per hectare per year, so they don't kick in until then. And until then, the only control on nitrogen, or the, if you think of it as the permitted baseline, is down in Roman numeral 2, B2 of that same rule. So the current permitted baseline for discharging nitrogen is that you're permitted as long as you are keeping your overseer records. And that's the only control, isn't it, in the permitted rule?
That is correct.
Yeah. And just to round that off, Plan Change 8 doesn't address either that overland flow rule or the discharge, the diffuse discharge of nitrogen, does it?
It's the gap in terms of the management of nitrogen has not been filled by Plan Change 8. To some degree, the NES, which sets a limit on a synthetic fertilizer, nitrogen discharges fills that, but I acknowledge that it's not a complete fill at all. And within the water plan, there's nothing. The Plan Change 8 does try to address a number of water quality issues to partially fill the gaps created by Plan Change 6AA, but we mainly target through that plan change high-risk activities, such as animal waste systems and effluent ponds.
Yes. Good. Okay, thank you. Right, so now, again, just picking up from something that Her Honour asked you about this morning, in terms of whether there's an environmental objective to this plan change as opposed to just a process-related objective. So as notified, the objective 10A11, it is a process, a solely process-related objective. It does not refer to any environmental goals or outcomes. Is that correct?
That is correct, yes.
There is a general vague reference to long-term sustainable management. That's about as close as it gets, isn't it?
That is a reference. What we refer to there is the planning regime that will be established under the new land and water plan.
Now, I could have a quite a laborious cross-examination on this theme, but I could go straight to the point, which is in several places, not just in your written evidence, but even today, you have said quite sensibly that one of the aims of this plan change is to halt environmental degradation and prevent further overallocation.
Correct.
Now, that would not be too difficult to articulate in Objective 10A11, something along those lines, and what Fish and Games witness Mr Farrell has done in his marked-up version is a start at articulating the environmental part of the objective alongside the process part. So perhaps if you have a look at that version of Mr Farrell's track changes. So, you've got that?
Yes.
So, one way of articulating the environmental arm of the objective of this plan change is a statement along the lines of protect the health and well-being of water bodies by avoiding further degradation of fresh water. Now, would you agree that that's consistent with the environmental objective of this plan change?
Avoiding further degradation of fresh water, I would agree. If you look at protecting the health and well-being of water bodies in isolation, it is something that requires a lot more than just avoiding further allocation.
Exactly, which is why you have to link it very explicitly to the fact that this is a stepping stone towards protecting health and well-being by stopping degradation now, for starters. That's the intent of tying those words to the first limb of Te Mana o Te Wai, protect the health and well-being of water, by avoiding further degradation at the moment, because this is a process whereby we're buying more time. It's intended to read in that context.
I know, but I agree with you, but the words avoiding further degradation of water also goes beyond merely managing water quantity or allocation, which is something that this plan change does, but it does not address discharges.
Correct. But it's not inconsistent with the aim of this plan change, is it?
No, but the risk, as I mentioned before, is of having this wording in the objective is that you won't achieve the objective through the policies and the rules of the plan change by itself.
What if you qualified that then to take away the risk of the water quality aspects, avoiding further degradation caused by over-allocation? Could qualify it again?
Can I look at a definition of over-allocation?
Yeah, yes. Sure, because we're going to get there anyway. Yeah. Yeah.
Again, it's a tricky one because over-allocation is defined also by making reference to limits in general, which can be take limits as well as resource limits, which again brings us to water quality aspects. And same with the words degradation or degrading. They go beyond purely managing water quantity.
No, you're absolutely right. In terms of the NPS, degraded, we can't make an NPS finding of degradation in this context, because degraded is, at every limb, is very explicitly linked to the values that have been identified for the FMU, the target attribute states for those values, the limits set. So we can't make an NPS finding, but when we can't make an NPS finding, we can look at part two. Part two requires that life supporting capacity be protected, that the significant habitat of important indigenous species be protected, and to a certain extent the habitat of trout and salmon also be protected. We can make a finding about degraded in that part two context, can't we?
Does that create a risk that there's going to be a tension between how it's defined in the Part 2 context and how it's defined in the NPSFM? I guess, does it create a risk of... Sorry, I'm not intending to ask you questions. that's not my intent.
Well, I'll put it to you. Are you concerned about the tension between a Part 2 finding that's inconsistent with an NPS definition? Is that your concern?
I think at the end of the day, whatever we write as planners is going to be used by consents officers, and you want to be you want to be as clear as possible and avoid the risk of different interpretations. It's about consistent decision-making. So I'm not trying to dismiss your suggestions. I'm just trying to... gauge what the implications might be.
And it might be, and there's a theme here from the other my friend's questions, the less discretion there is in that, what's meant to be the carrot rule, that very easy rule, the less discretion there is in there, the the smaller that risk is of confusion.
That is correct, yeah.
Yep. So, still looking at Mr. Farrell's drafting, another suggestion from Mr. Farrell is that he's actually separated out the three additional limbs that were in the policy, A, B, and C, which were more process limbs of your objective. He's suggested that as those are doing clauses or a doing provision, if you like, that it's more appropriate that that sit as a policy. Do you agree with that?
I think a policy generally sets out the how. So in that regard, I don't see any issues with the policy as suggested. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And sorry, I skipped down too fast. The other change in the main limb of the objective is the deletion of the word resources after freshwater. And in Mr. Farrell's reasoning for that is that that turns water into something that's for human use. It's looked at as a resource. It's anthropocentric rather than water having its own mana, mauri, hauora. And so by deleting the word resources, it changes that that focus, that paradigm. So would you agree with deletion of the word resources from that limb?
It doesn't create any problems at all. I think I appreciate Mr. Farrell's rationale and... I think it's sensible, and it doesn't really, like I said, it doesn't create any problems for the objective. Talking about fresh water instead of fresh water resources,
and it's more consistent, isn't it, with the objective on Te Mana o Te Wai, the first limb that is
correct.
Just about the
correct,
water,
yeah,
not the people, yeah. The other change is deletion of the phrase long term from the main limb of the objective. Do you have any problem with the deletion of that word, those words?
My response to that was we really want to distinguish between this planning framework, which is a process-driven planning framework, and the planning framework that is going to be in the land and water plan. The long term makes it clear that the sustainable management will be achieved through the new land and water plan, not by this plan change. Hence, my recommendation to stick to the word long term.
Shouldn't we not assume? Sorry, double negative. It might not take that long. Why should we assume now that that is going to be a long-term process given everything that we've still got to come?
It's not a long-term process. It's a longer-term planning regime, a planning regime that will be in place for a longer term than this one.
What you mean to say is, in the long term, there will be this new plan. That's really what you're getting at.
Yeah.
Correct.
In the
yes,
long term.
Yeah.
You know,
which is not
in
that
the
long.
Term, it's, yeah. Yeah.
Okay, that's fine. Thank you. So now I just want to turn to your evidence in chief and your paragraph 44 that you were taken to by my friend. Where you've identified the five significant resource management issues. And what I, again, to try and shortcut... to the answer that I was hoping you'd give me at the end, isn't it correct that in addition to those five matters, the other significant issue that this plan change addresses is halting further over-allocation and degradation associated with that? The holding of the line.
Well,
is
that is
the significant issue that this plan change is actually addressing, isn't it?
That is actually the response in the plan change. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
I guess
so. That's probably the first significant issue, isn't it, that this plan change addresses?
are you... I'm trying to avoid asking you questions. Are you referring to the state of the environment, the current state of the environment? As do you see that as a...
Is it? Yeah, so what I'm referring to is the current state of the environment in places is degraded. We've got evidence, you know, lots of evidence from Edward Allison, we've got Richard Allibone, we've got the Department of Conservation witnesses, we've got Fish and Game witnesses, all have given evidence in various places about where there's degradation associated with extreme allocation.
Yeah. That is the case for some places, but acknowledging that there are some data gaps, so we cannot make a... give an overall picture of what the state is of the environment throughout the region, and that is one of our issues that we're dealing with.
But the other issue is that there is information that there is degradation associated with the level of abstraction. And that is why
places,
you need to hold the line and not let consents be granted on a case-by-case basis.
Yep.
Now, if, I just want to jump quickly to the controlled activity rule. And this is just picking up on, again, some themes from my friends about whether there should be the entry point to the controlled activity rule that refers to Schedule 2A minimum flows. And what became apparent to me when Mr. Henderson, I think, was being asked questions, or it might have been Mr. Allibone, in terms of the Marahirakia and the Tairi specifically, and as I took it from, I think it was Mr. Henderson's exchange with, I think, Ms. Irving, that the Schedule 2A minimum flows for the Marahirakia and the Tairi are already complied with by virtue of the design of the, you know, falls dam releasing the augmented flows and the top storage and upper Tairi releasing flows and so on and so forth. So I just wanted to clarify with you, is your understanding that the Schedule 2A minimum flows for the Marahirakia and the Tairi are actually currently complied with anyway by, you know, as a consequence of how those schemes are
definitely
run?
For the Marahirakia?
Yep.
For the Tairi... I know, or I recall, that the Manitoto Irrigation Company maintains the minimum flow at certain points in the river, but the Tairi has five different minimum flow sites, and I could not give you a clear answer as to whether those other minimum flows are adhered to.
Because what I'm trying to understand is whether or not submitters seeking that the Schedule 2A minimum flows be added as an entry point requirement to the controlled activity rule, is that actually an issue given what's happening in the Schedule 2A catchments? Do you have a feeling for whether there are deemed permits that are currently being used that take below the Schedule 2A minimum flows? Is this actually a problem we need to worry ourselves about? And if you can't answer it, what I was going to suggest is that we've got Exhibit ORC1 with the current summary of deemed permits not applied for or in train. I don't think it would take too much to compare that list of catchments with the, quite honestly, quite limited list of catchments in Schedule 2. There's not actually that many minimum flows in there. And see if any of the outstanding deemed permits are actually relevant to the Schedule 2A minimum flows, and then get to the bottom of the Tairi situation as well.
Oh, well, we can do that over the tea break. Can you remind me whether it's the case that some people who are seeking minimum flows, you know, the Schedule 2 minimum flows, are not do so without proposing an allocation block at the same time. Now, I don't think that's you. I think your client is minimifies an allocation.
Not for the... check that.
Yeah.
No, we're just focused on the minimum flow. Because the allocation block, that's a big change.
Yeah.
If you impose so that as an entry point.
Yeah, okay, so I just want to go back to where your relief is. Hold on. Okay, so I see. So, for example, in your control rule, the entry point would be an application that's put up a minimum flow, but nothing. But there's no allocation block otherwise applying to that rule.
No.
Now, that potentially could be problematic. So I can ask the questions, or you can ask the questions as to why that might be potentially problematic.
But to not have an allocation block?
Yeah.
Well...
for the reasons that Dr. Hayes, I think Dr. Hayes is your witness.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, so isn't his evidence that minimum blocks and minimum flows, allocation blocks work together? And so that if you've got a large number of people coming onto a new minimum flow, then the potential for that is to bring the level of flow in the river down to the minimum flow and hold it there in dry conditions. Mm-hmm. And that's problematic, I would have thought, or potentially problematic for the environment. So I wasn't quite sure why we were suggesting that here.
Well, what I'm exploring, and this is just for the controlled activity 6-year rollover, on the assumption that some of these deemed permits, that this is the assumption that I think we actually need to clarify, is this actually a thing? Is this an issue? That some of the deemed permits are taking water below... down from the minimum flow to even less.
That could already be under there.
So it's already under
it.
Yeah. So all that would do is bring up the bed situation a little bit higher for the same amount of time. So the flatlining, yes. But in the context, what Fish and Game agrees with is that this controlled activity rule should be as easy as possible to get through.
Mm.
And if everyone is actually currently complying with the 2A minimum flows, where it's relevant to this plan change, then that's easy.
Mm-hmm.
They are actually already complying. It's not a disincentive. Mm-hmm. But if there are quite a handful of them that aren't currently applying and that turns into a disincentive to even look at the controlled activity rule, I think that's a very important point for everybody to understand.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think in part of that that discussion, we've talked about Manahere Kia and Tai'i as if it's only if they are only the two catchments, which of course they're not. We don't have a sense yet when people are talking about those two catchments. Are they talking about the FMU-scaled catchments, which are kind of super catchments, or something which is not an FMU but actually quite smaller than that, and that's what this operative plan, applies to? We're kind of going to ask... we are going to ask Mr Moore to have his witnesses, planning witnesses, regulatory witnesses clarify that. We don't have a sense yet for each of those Schedule 2 catchments. We have no sense as to how many permits are actually out there, and of those permits, what are up for replacement because they're deemed or because they would have permits up for replacement in the next 2 years. What's trucking along not up for replacement, which may have a minimum flow, though it does sound doubtful, that they do have any minimum flows imposed. So I don't know what's under the line, what's above the line.
Yeah.
So I just, we're sitting there going, we're a bit blind, actually, we're a bit blind, potentially, to the implications of this policy and are very concerned you'll flatline the river.
Mm. Yeah. Mm. Make it worse or...
Definitely.
Or it might not be an issue. We might find out.
Or it might not be an issue. So
yeah.
Then if you need more information, and we certainly think you need more information to pursue this because Dr. Hayes' evidence was so legible, so it was good evidence on the relationships.
Yes.
You need to be asking me, and I'll ask Mr. Moore. You can ask this witness, but I just think it's coming in such a you know, piecemeal fashion, which is no criticism of you because it's just the function of the questioning. It'd be actually good to get it on paper.
Yeah, no, I think, we agree about what it is we need to figure out. So I'll leave it for now with this witness.
Yeah, and perhaps talk to Mr. Moore
over the break.
Do you want to park it there and talk to Mr. Moore and then we can come back, take break early and then come back? How's that sound?
Yes, okay. Thank you.
Then we'll take it from there. Alrighty, we're adjourned.
All rise.